Hey everyone, this is Chris and you're listening to the Live Fix Podcast, the podcast that explores the concert fan experience. We believe live music is life-altering. Join us as we share stories and connect with concert fans to discover how live music forever rocks our world before, during, and after the show. Thanks for listening and enjoy the episode. Greetings, live music fans. Live music has a tremendous and profound impact on our hearts and human physiology. The connection between what we feel physically and what we feel emotionally in our heart is one of the most powerful experiences we have at a concert. So what actually happens to our physical hearts during a show? Can live music actually heal our hearts? Can we visualize the actual physical impact of live music on our hearts? In this episode, we explore all these questions and we dive into the fascinating and inspiring work of Elaine Chu. Elaine is Professor of Engineering at King's College London in the Department of Engineering and the School of Biomedical Engineering and Imaging Sciences. She is also a concert pianist and currently leads two European Research Council projects, Cosmos and Heart FM. In her work, she's investigating the effects of performed music on both musicians and listeners' physiology. As much as possible, she aims to use live music in her studies, as this has been shown to have a more powerful effect. In this episode, we explore how she began playing as a concert pianist. We take a look at how our physical hearts are impacted by live music, and we also discover the powerful and life-changing advice her piano teacher gave her right before her very first performance. We look at her work in researching the healing power and influence of live music on cardiovascular issues. We talk about her favorite shows and performers. And among other topics, we have a little fun exploring what would happen if you transplanted and swapped the hearts of two different concert fans. Elaine, thank you so much for joining us. Excited to have you here.
Thank you for having me. I'm very excited to see how this goes too.
Yeah, we came across your work, and you know, with the vision and you know the focus of our podcast here, we were talking like we have to get Elaine on the show. And have you explain, you know, your work, share your work, what you've been doing throughout your career, we'd love to start also with kind of how did you get into music? I know you're a concert pianist and I've seen some of your performances but how did you get started? Like what led you to music and to the piano?
It was kind of a surprise to my family. it was never intended my getting into music and becoming a musician. You know, like all good Asian parents, actually they didn't make me take music. According to my mom, I one day, because we lived next door to a piano teacher, just said to her, "I want to learn the piano." She would bring this back years later when I refused to practice. She said, "You wanted to do this." And so I got into playing piano. As you can see, I was not a very good student. I didn't like practicing. But what really changed things for me was one year my dad took a sabbatical. We lived in Singapore and we traveled to Vancouver for half a year. And during that time in Vancouver, I did not have access to a piano, and we didn't have a piano. I could only go into the elementary school I was in on Wednesday afternoons when there was no school. That was the only time I could play the piano. And at that time, I had brought some books with me. I would sight read through books and books of piano. I would go through pieces, and that really taught me that I really loved playing. And it was because I couldn't play so much that I really discovered my love for playing. And so when I returned from Vancouver, my piano teacher actually said, "Oh, Elaine, you've improved so much. You should skip a grade and move on to the next one." And that was how it began. Music became my life. It became everything. And it was the way through which I expressed thoughts, feelings. It was just a wonderful language through which I could communicate with others and bring to them bring to them ways to access their own worlds as well as to discover new worlds through music.
And did you actually see a lot of live music shows when you were younger?
Not so much, I have to admit. I didn't have the opportunity or wasn't sort of in the environment where I went out to see a lot of live music shows. What happened was I, as part of my music education, I had to play in concerts. And so that was my experience of live music. My first experiences were hearing the other students play, of hearing how to approach music, of discovering how to learn about music and how what music could do through these really wonderful lessons. I had a fabulous teacher. Well, I had a series of fabulous teachers, and I was very fortunate in that way who really imparted their knowledge of how to really make music be sort of the channel through which you could really paint entire new vistas and create new experiences for others.
Yeah, that's amazing. And looking at your, I mean, that's a lot of what I know. Before we hit record here, we were talking about kind of you asked us what got into our passion, mm-hmm. and wanting to be able to understand the why, right, of what's happening.
Yeah.
When audiences are experiencing music, and a lot of your mm-hmm. work is understanding the why and also how to. It's almost a lot of your work is the why, but also what can you do with that? You know, what levers can mm-hmm. you push? What switches mm-hmm. can you turn on, turn off as you're doing that to get certain reactions? And why do those reactions happen? Which is fascinating. And when we asked you your first concert that you ever went to, you said it was your teacher's student concert. What was that? Mm-hmm. What was that experience like for you? Your very first concert when you were playing, and what did you learn from that? And how does that impact your work today?
Oh gosh, I think how that as you know, student concerts are not the epitome of a skilled performance. So we were all learning, and we were in the case of a student concert, especially one where you had to play in. I think it was really good to start that very young, because I think at a very young age, there was simply no fear of playing in front of others. We learned that much later. We learned how to feel afraid. We learned how to feel afraid of failure much later in life. And so it was really a very, a positive experience, being able to play for others and to affect them. And I remember what I remember from those days was an incident when I was thrown into a competition, and I was one of the younger players, and I was I was very lucky to end up in the finals, where I got to play with a symphony orchestra, and it was a concerto performance. And before I got on stage, my teacher would say, "Well, go out there and forget about all the technical things and everything that we've been working on. Just go out there, and if anyone has any sadness in their hearts, play it so that they would cry and it would bring it out of them." And that was his last instruction before I went on stage. And that really stayed with me, the fact that music could be a source, an instrument. Music could be the instrument for eliciting, pulling emotions out of people that they perhaps were not able to express yet. It gave them a channel, an avenue of expression that it was really a way for them to access parts of themselves that were maybe hidden or submerged. And that was, for me, what was beautiful about being a musician. Being a musician was being able to reach out to people, being able to draw these things out of them, and to have an impact on their lives.
It's so amazing that unconscious messages that the band mm-hmm. or the musician can give to their fans, and it's like without mm-hmm. words. It's without words, yes. Often.
Mm. Yeah, yeah, and I know that this podcast is about live music, and I think one of the really great things about the live experience is the interaction between the performer and the listener and the audience, because in the live setting, what it allows the performer to do is to adapt the message, to adapt the performance, to adapt how the music is being communicated, as depending on what they sense from the audience. And so this can't be done in a recorded performance. A recorded performance is static, it doesn't change. It was recorded for in a particular occasion for some particular situation, and it has been archived for posterity. And in the live experience, what is really magical is that I think being a performer, musician is also about being very sensitive, being able to sense how the audience is reacting to the music. So, for example, if you're speaking on stage or if you're playing on stage, you know, when people start rustling their programs, that you kind of almost lost them. You need to sort of bring them back. And if you sense that suddenly there's this hush and stillness, that you can, there's a willingness to go where you want to take them. And I think that is something that can't be replaced. I don't think AI is at that stage yet where we can actually do that kind of adaptive performance. And that's kind of related to some of the research we're trying to do, to see if we can understand this interaction between the performance and the audience. Like, what in the performance is the audience reacting to dynamically over time? And we're trying to do this in a way that sort of shows the adaptation. I mean, this is a two-way conversation. It's not something that is it's not about receiving the music or being the person who's who is the star who's performing the music. It's about this mutual interaction between the person who needs to deliver this music and the people who are at this as this music is being delivered, reacting to it. And I know there's lots of studies about music and people's reception. It's been the topic of music psychology for many, many years. There's thousands of papers out there about people's responses to how the listener, how the audience responds to the music. But one of the things that we are really interested in right now is the beyond the mental experience of music, we are interested in trying to draw what that music does to our body, because this live music experience particularly is a very visceral experience. You feel it in your body, you feel it, you feel the vibrations, you respond physically to it. We want to capture what that physical bodily response is. So in our lab, our current studies have been targeted at cardiovascular response. So what's in your heart? What's your heart doing? How is it responding to the music? And the heart is one of these amazing organs that sort of tells you how you're feeling. when you're very excited about something, when you're very excited about someone, it sort of beats faster. When you're calm, it's sort of beats in a very different way, versus when you're scared, it also beats very differently. So we're trying to capture cardiovascular responses to music, and through that to really understand what it is that music does to people. And because we want to get the strongest response possible, whenever we can, we actually work with live music. Or music from actual acoustic instruments that are sending these auditory vibrations to the body.
And how are you? What's the environment like for that live experience? Are you taking this hypothesis and experiment into a concert experience, like a live concert experience, and with mm-hmm. fans and artists, or how have you been testing that?
We've started quite small. We started some years ago with since I play the piano, we did a small mini piano concert, and we invited heart patients. Actually, in particular, we actually invited pacemaker patients to the study. So these are people who have perhaps mild heart failure, and they have a pacemaker that's been installed in their hearts. So there are these leads that go into your hearts to pace the heart to make sure it's beating regularly. And should there be any rhythm disturbances, it will shock the heart back into rhythm. But what this means is that we have these are people who have leads that go into the insides of the hearts and a touch on the muscles inside the hearts. And because of that, we are able to record the exact electrical activity from inside their hearts as they're listening to the live piano concert. So this was quite special, and we were very privileged to have patients willing to come listen to the concert. And an interesting thing is because they have these pacemakers, it means their hearts are paced. So we actually don't have their heart rates increasing or decreasing. What we're actually looking at is whether the signals, the electrical activity in their hearts, whether the signals a change in shape. So basically, whether the recovery period after the heart beats, after that's triggered, whether the recovery period gets shortened when they're excited or stressed, and whether or not it gets, how it varies really over time. And the other interesting thing is because these pacemakers, musicians will love this. Pacemakers are basically like a click track. So this is a click track for the heart. And because if the heart rate goes higher, so if the tempo goes higher, this could change the kinds of things we're measuring, which is the activation recovery period interval. And so if this if this heart rate goes too high and it exceeds some threshold, then the pacemaker actually changes its pacing rates to go along with the heart rate. So what was done was we had the help of the device makers. In this case, it was the Abbott, and they could program the pacemaker to change it to beat just a little bit higher than the intrinsic rate, if your intrinsic heart rate was 60 beats per minute, it would be raised to 70 beats per minute. And so that even if the patients got a little more excited with listening to music, or they got more stimulated with the music, the heart rate wouldn't change beyond the higher threshold. And so in this setting, we had, I don't know, maybe this is kind of too much detail, but I thought this is really cool. You know, this is like the human heart is what keeps us alive.
I feel like you're cracking open the heart for us. And no, really, this is, so it's great.
No, this is fantastic, Elaine, because we did, I've always been a big fan of Super Curious. I've done experiments on myself at concerts, five senses of, I've wondered for years what is happening in my heart, right, both at a unconscious level or what's physiology, if I'm, because I love a lot of different genres, right? I love everything from classical to heavy metal, right? And everything in between. And what I'm wondering is if you have any theories or if you've seen any research, research that you've done, if there is a difference in genres, right? Because I'm thinking like that I've had different heart responses when I go and see, like I was at my my kid's piano recital, and I was watching everybody play, and I think it depends on who you're seeing playing, right? Because I noticed I had a different reaction when I was seeing my kids play, and then I had a different reaction in my heart. The physiology also, and some of the psychology, what I was feeling emotional when I would see a different kid play, right? And and then when I go to see Kanye West versus Metallica, and my heart's doing different things during those concerts, and there's all these different things going on. I was wondering, do you have any thoughts on that, or any research of the different effects of different instruments, different genres, different styles on the heart?
Well, I'm not an expert on that, so I can't speak authoritatively about it. At the moment, we have genres are very important, and so is your personal attraction to particular genres. So what what may sound real fascinating to one person, another person may hate. So it's really hard to say that for a genre and for all people what that genre will do. What we have been focusing on are more directly sort of in the immediate senses of when we receive music, what do we perceive as changing? So for example, if the music is getting louder, if the timbre of the sound suddenly changes. So we actually will, we are looking at the sensory part of music communication. So if we were looking at speech, that would be called the prosody of speech, or looking at the prosody of musical communication. So for example, when we speak to people, when we speak to others, when we want to communicate excitement, when we want to communicate anger, when we want to communicate, when we want to gently convince them of something, the voice changes. I mean, it's the same thing in music. And this kind of expressive variations are transcend genres. It is in a way something that is common to musical communication. We can tell when your child is angry at you because of the way they're speaking, and we can tell when someone is feeling very dreamy because of the way their voice changes. And music uses these very these universal cues to allow us to express things that might be, that are beyond words. They are beyond what we can say. They are a way of expressing feelings or thoughts that transcend language. So, I mean, people call music a language, but in a way, it's sort of a language without words. So this is what we've been looking at. So the responses we're looking at are the responses to these kinds of parameters. So what happens when, let's say, the timbre suddenly softens, this voice suddenly softens, the voice of the instrument suddenly softens, what does that do? But then it's too narrow to actually look at what happens in that particular situation, because how we listen to music, as in how we listen to stories, it's very contextual. It depends on what came before, what's coming after, how we're feeling that day. And so there's so much complexity in how we interact with music that we hope to be able to make some headway in this. It's wonderful for us. This is fascinating. This is an unending source of questions and things that we can investigate. So our hope is to be able to say something about this, something substantial about this one day.
Do you find that, you know, we talked to a lot of different concert fans that do, you know, week-long festivals, or, you know, we're right in the kind of the middle of Coachella here in California. So people will go to, it's two weekends, and so they'll go all weekend to see shows nonstop. And so I'm wondering, is there anything in your research that shows that, you know, 5 minutes is better or not as good as a weekend of music?
On the heart. Yeah. Is there any research on that? Yeah, because we've been to these festivals, and yeah, Coachella's going on, weekend two is just about to start. And we were wondering about that, where, you know, what's the effect on the heart with you know,
long-term exposure, I guess you could say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And which is better, right?
Yes.
Like which is better on the heart?
That's a great question, because that sort of like opens a whole door to lots of things the first thing is the length of exposure. And in most studies, the length of exposure is like 90 seconds. One of the things we've been trying to do is to push that. We're having people listen to 30, 40 minutes of music. And one of the challenges of doing research that does that is we had to build software to capture cardiac data for that length of time. So typically, if you own an Apple Watch, for example, the ECG recording is only for 30 seconds. And 30 seconds is not long enough for a piece of music. And so we've had to build the software and the systems that connect different devices together to capture data for longer periods of time, to pull data from devices and to actually process that data ourselves. So that has been a large part of our work, to be able to capture that music experience over more realistic time periods. And we were only thinking 30, 40 minutes, and hopefully one day to extend it to a full concert. But here, what you're saying is a whole weekend of concerts. I think that's fabulous, because in one way, that gives us a way, an entry into trying to see what does long-term exposure to music do to people. And in this case, like two weekends. And we can also, but at the same time, when a person is listening to music for that long, it's hard to tell which part of their mind is actually focused on the music for a particular period of time. Maybe they are fully focused on it for the first few minutes or even the first half hour. But what happens after that? Are they thinking about other things? Are they thinking about what they said to their friend? Are they thinking about what happened to their I don't know what happened to their dogs that day. As a researcher trying to control factors and trying to understand how do we capture that response to music, and perhaps daydreaming while listening to music is a response to music. But what does that then mean? How do we actually capture that? So that's really fascinating.
And the excitement factor that comes in too, like you're getting all excited, you get ready for the show, you're in the bathroom getting ready and you're wearing your favorite shirt, and then you're meeting your best buddies to go to the concert. And so you could show up with like a high level, hearts beating fast already at that moment.
Yeah, and I often wonder too. Yeah. Oh, go ahead, Aline, sorry.
Go ahead. I was just thinking heart beating faster. And that's, that's the other thing. Music, for so much, a lot of music therapy is directed at producing a calming meditative state. But actually, music also excites people. And part of the excitement that comes with going to music performances, music concerts, I think in a way it's very good for people. I don't think that, I think that that dynamism of music in creating excitement and is perhaps maybe in a way likened to exercise being good for us. So, exercising the heart in that way through music, which is kind of innocuous stimulus, allows the heart to become more resilient, perhaps. That's a hypothesis to be proven in the future.
Yeah, you're reading my mind. I was just going to ask you that.
Or your heart.
You're reading my heart. Yeah, there you go. Nice. That was a good one. But I was thinking the same thing, because when I go to concerts, I know my heart does certain things, and then when I work out or, I do a lot of athletic activity, right? And there's a certain amount of, there's training involved. My heart's getting stronger when I'm doing that. And then okay, when I go to a concert, and I'm getting stimulated from the music or from the social interaction or emotions being conjured by the music, what is that impact on my heart? Is my heart developing in a different way?
Have memory,
because there's the right, there's the whole idea of like there's the physical heart, right, that we're talking about, and then there's the spiritual heart, right, there's the soul, right, and I think those two, there's been debates about that the whole human history, right, about
Egyptians are those, or maybe before,
and then throw the mind in there too, we haven't even
but like you read my mind, Elaine. I'm like, well, when I'm working out and when I'm going to a show, in the middle of the show, when that concert hits that epiphany and my favorite song and everybody's, we have our hands in the air and we're moving, or there's a mosh pit going on, or, everybody's like, everybody's lifted, so to speak, and, our heart rate is, we all have the same heart rate maybe at some point. Like, what is what is the difference, or are those two experiences the same? Is my heart getting healthy by going to a show in a different way versus working out, getting at getting into zone two or zone three for 30-40 minutes? Like, what's the, like, is there a concert zone for my heart, right? Because I know I can train my heart and track it. I have my handy dandy watch that I make sure I'd stay my beats permitted, and I'm watching my heart rate when I'm working out. But what I've realized is that I don't watch my heart rate when I go to a show. You know, should I be doing that?
I should, right?
And is it maybe...
Maybe you should do yoga next time, the spike. When you're at the show.
Well, we did do that. The festivals, a lot of the festivals, they have yoga where you can
do. Yeah, they offer yoga.
You can do yoga, you know, with...
But not at the same time as the music.
Usually not. Well, sometimes they'll have studio music, never live music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So,
they should, though. That would be really interesting.
Yeah.
That would be interesting. Yes.
Yeah.
No, that's... Well, yeah.
Yeah, the one thing I wanted to ask you about too, Elaine, was some of your work. And I actually, a significant part of it, there were some of the articles I read and some of the videos that I was checking out about what you were doing. And and the work gets into the concept of being able to understand what music can do, and then the concept and the idea that artists can manipulate the moment, so to speak. You know, they can do a certain thing with a certain structure of notes and tones to make the listener feel a certain way, like your teacher said, like make them feel sad, you know, or tap into that. And it got me thinking, and this is what I wanted to ask you about, is, you know, do you think that, you know, there is a connection between a really good performance and that artist's ability to manipulate, you know, that, and, you know, manipulate that audience? Like, are the better the performance, the more manipulation, or is, you know, and we're using manipulation, I think sometimes that has a bad connotation, but maybe when we buy the ticket and we go to the show, we're like, please manipulate me.
Yes, right? That's right.
You're paying for manipulation.
Right. Yes, right. Exactly.
We've given our hard-earned money to be manipulated in a good way, or maybe in a way we didn't expect. But what do you think about that? I mean, is there a connection between a really great performer and their ability to manipulate? And do you think fans go into an experience wanting to be manipulated? And maybe,
yes, you know, absolutely. I think it's perhaps like sitting in a psychologist's chair. you willingly go, you want to be explored or led to different places. And I mean, two things come to mind. One is that in some ways, yes, the skill of the artist has something to do with how well they do this manipulation. And so that's, but if you're a skilled performer and you're doing this regularly, this is to be expected, that you know how to do this, just as you expect that, you know, a carpenter that you hire to build some shelves has the skill to do that well. So this is the craft of performance. So the performer, the artist, has a certain tool sets that they can draw from, but how successful that experience that they shape is depends a lot on the moment, depends on the audience. Really, I mean, they couldn't do this if the audience didn't work with them. The artist is not the only person that shapes this moment. And part of these special moments that come in live performance is sort of the audience, the fans and the artists sensing each other, sensing what it is that the other needs at that moment. And it's a very human thing. So I mean, just to give a concrete example, one of the things that I have written about is this thing about tipping points, performing is all about managing people's expectations, playing with them, and giving them a good time when these expectations are played with. So if you play the piece straight, nobody's going to, to be particularly moved or applaud at it. Nobody came to the concert to have the piece played straight. I mean, you could have your machine play that for you. So the whole concert experience is about this manipulation of expectations, this playing with that, and the anticipation and the fulfillment of these anticipations and the playing in the case of classical music, playing with the time and stretching it so that you prolong these expectations and then you deliver what's expected. And then people feel this endorphins or no, not endorphins. This pleasure having their expectations fulfilled, having expected the right thing, and then receiving it, and then moving on to the next thing. It's a beautiful dance. It's a dance between people, and it's that. I guess the short answer is, you know, skills are not it. It is the moment, the timing, plus, you know, having the skills to pull it off.
And it seems that our bodies are really created to enjoy music in many ways.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. But I know there's some shows that we've done and talked about skin. And now we're talking about the heart. Ah. We've talked about the brain. And so there's mm-hmm. so many facets to the human being that just is just this, there's so much pleasure in sound and music being
yes.
given to us. A fascinating thing that I had heard, and maybe you can comment mm-hmm. on this. I was dragged to a training a while back, and the training actually was amazing. It was a woman who had a heart transplant, and she discussed how transplants actually change the person's makeup when they actually get a new heart.
Oh, yeah.
Change what they mm-hmm. like, what they don't like. She had had a very traumatic early childhood trauma, and she had felt like she could never with all the talk therapy in the world and holistic approaches could not overcome those thoughts and the nightmares and some of the PTSD.
Wow.
But when she had the transplant, which was due to health issues, that mm-hmm. had lifted. She had felt that just lifted and wasn't there anymore the way it was before. Of course, she didn't forget it because her brain is there, but the mm-hmm. physical manifestations of the trauma were not there anymore. And
that's fascinating.
She had said during that talk, and I remember specifically, that she started enjoying spicy foods and she started liking salsa dancing. And that kind of for her came out of nowhere because she had never eaten spicy foods and never was into salsa dancing. So I'm just curious if you've ever come across any of that research or have heard of any stories about just that when the heart is transplanted into mm-hmm. somebody else.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I'm thinking of a live music fan, right? I'm thinking more
right.
like someone who was into music. Maybe they saw like, you know, Bob Dylan, or they saw the Rolling Stones, or Janis Joplin, or they went to Woodstock. And then all of a sudden that person, unfortunately, something happens to them, and then it gets transplanted else who doesn't like any of that music, but then starts enjoying that and maybe seeks out those live shows. So I'm just curious if you've had an experience with that.
If we were to take like the heart of a hip hop fan and transplant it into the body of a classical, some completely era, and, you know, have them have that person go to a show, right? Go like, would there be a difference? What that experience would be?
That's
right?
Fascinating.
You started swapping the hearts out of different fans and putting them in different areas. Like, would there be, you know, I'm not saying we're going to get
it's very sci-fi.
We're not talking like
it's happened.
You know, Dr. Moreau here,
yes.
I'm just curious about what are your thoughts on that? Like, if
it's not that far off. You know? It truly is not that far off. And it's funny that you should bring that up, because I had been talking to colleagues about what happens to transplant patients. Because one of the things that connects our brains to the heart is the autonomic nervous system. And the autonomic nervous system controls the automatic processes in the body. So things like heart rate, things like breathing, things like digestion. So the autonomic nervous system consists of two different pathways. One is the sympathetic pathway and the other one is the parasympathetic. And the sympathetic pathway is the one that sort of gives us the fight or flight response. So, you know, when your heart rate suddenly goes way up and you're ready to run and ready to fight, that is the sympathetic system coming into play. The parasympathetic are kind of like the opposite. It sort of is the calming, calm down and digest mode of the body. And so this autonomic nervous system, a dense network of nerves that connect the brain to the heart, the heart to the brain. And there will be people, there are researchers who believe or have shown that the heart actually sends more signals to the brain than the brain to the heart. So actually we sense our responses to things, to emotions from the body. The heart is telling the brain what we're feeling and the brain sort of acting on it, or the brain is also telling the heart, you know, what, oh no, we see something fearful coming that you should be afraid of. And so then the heart responds. So that's one thing, but when someone has a heart transplant, what happens is that whole network gets cut. They no longer have the communication to the brain. So a person who receives a new heart from someone else, they don't connect up the autonomic nervous system back up to the brain. So it grows back over time, partially, but at the moment when the heart is transplanted in, the person's not receiving the signals from the brain. That heart is not receiving signals from the brain. So it's missing a whole bunch of information. And maybe some of your friend who felt the early trauma suddenly disappeared, could explain some of it. The fact that the brain's not telling the heart to be on alert all the time because of that trauma, because of that PTSD. And so that in a way was very helpful. I don't know about the salsa dancing. I don't know how to explain that. But, yeah. So I it would be worth going back to see the person who died, whose heart your friend received, whether that person was into salsa dancing and whether that could be remnants of that. So if you had fans, we were trying to figure out if research on music response deals with the neuroscience of music response. So what happens to transplant patients if they're not getting messages from the brain? Do they no longer respond to music? So that was the question I had, and I was asking colleagues about that. And in fact, my sister as well, who does neuro rehab. And the thought was that even when the brain's not sending messages to the heart, there are other sensors in the body that is communicating with the heart. So it is still receiving messages about what the body needs to respond to its environment, and so there probably would still be some responds to different kinds of music, perhaps not as complete as before a heart transplant, but that there would still be responses. But that study has not yet been done, so it might be something we could look into in the future. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it sounds awesome. Yeah, it sounds almost like the body's receiving responses, but the responses are potentially out of context. You know, they don't have the context of like, why do I love salsa dancing all of a sudden, or what?
Right.
Like, what is this? I love this, like, this riff that, you know, Metallica is doing. Why? Like, what is, you know, okay, or you know, or yeah. I want them to drop some more beats, but Metallica won't, like, they're not lyrical enough or something, right? Like, give me some more, you know, a different beat, right? Or it's just interesting to think about that.
Yeah. Like the story of the moon wanting to date the sun. It never will happen.
You take out the mind. Connected.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, you take out those connections and the context is gone.
It's the gone.
The body is still trying to make sense of things, and it does the best it can. But if you snap those wires in the wrong places, then you lose context of what these feelings actually mean. And I want to ask you also about a lot of your work deals with math and formulas, and we talk a lot about the feelings and everything, and I was wondering about your mathematic approach to music, and if we think about the experience of an artist being able to do a certain thing well so that the performance is great for the fan. Like, is there you mentioned that a certain thing has to happen in a certain sequence in that show, and the artist has to be good at putting these things together. And I know math is very sequential. Things happen that, you know, there's a form, like math is formulas, right? Like, is there a formula for that an artist can follow? Like, or do artists have to come up with their own, you know, X plus Y equals, like,
or are they constantly testing out formulas?
Like, yeah. It's like, is there a perfect formula for great performance?
Gosh.
And can artists like hack that?
It's $1 million question.
Can they hack that? Like, can live performance be hacked by artists so that every show is like, you know, the show?
I think that the very quick answer to that is that once you find the formula for this show to be perfect, it will need to be superseded because people get bored with it. It won't work again and again and again. This is the creative part about performance. We adapt as humans. This is what is wonderful about the human mind. We learn things, and once we've learned it, and then it happens again and again and again, we go, oh, that's old hat. Now, what else can you give me pleasure from showing me something new? How can you push the boundaries just a little bit more and create that pleasurable feeling? We constantly seek new experiences, but at the same time, they mustn't be too new that they're completely foreign. So it needs to be just new enough that it will keep the fans coming.
And when you're saying that, I'm thinking of Madonna, you know, constantly transforming herself. I know she's coined as the queen of the tour, because she was the one that kind of started those grand tours where there was performances on stage and characters. And now we have, you know, Lady Gaga and Taylor Swift. And I'm sure there was someone before Madonna doing that, but she was sort of the one that had all the, you know, the funds to do that kind of production. And she's still inventing herself. I mean, now she's using a lot more social media, but she's still coming out with music. She's still performing. And she's someone who her music has changed so much from day one. She was kind of like a punk, street punk artist, and then became more pop, and, you know, and then now she's doing very more artistic type of collaborations. with younger artists, actually. So she's very involved. And it sounds like she kind of had to do that in order to keep her audience. Or people had to, you know, she probably has a team around her saying, like, we have to make this interesting. And some of those team members may know, you know, what it takes as far as the
music,
but the math behind it and all of those numbers.
What is the formula?
Yeah.
But what about the artists? Because you, but then you have, I'm gonna take the opposite side here, and I'm gonna do, I'm a little devil's advocate on this, because we often talk about a lot of same bands come up in conversations. You know, that fans are like, oh, I love this band. We're like, oh, they got mentioned again on another, you know, different shows, and a different, usually in the same way. And
I have to, the Beatles.
Right. Well,
we're always talking about the Beatles.
We almost went a whole show without mentioning the Beatles, but there it goes. But
they're the favorites.
The band that comes to mind, though, that I always ask about, especially in this, because this is a fantastic conversation, and I think it makes sense to ask about this band, and it's U2. So U2 fans, you know, they really love the U2 show, and this is from when we asked them, and you see this a lot, is that they do almost, it's very similar to the album. Like, they very rarely will they deviate from, you know, solo. I don't think they do a lot of solos. It's just, it is what you is, but they lean into the, you know, the theatrics of the performance, right? They have big stage stage sets and things like that, but they stick pretty much to what you can hear on the album is what you're going to hear at the show. So U2 is an example that I wanted to bring up. And then the formula, right? And then the other part is that you often hear this where a fan will say, man, I wish they would play my favorite song. They didn't play my favorite song, you know, or they wanted, or the artist has changed too much. They need to go back to their roots.
They
deviated too far from what I liked. Yes. Right. And there's a lot of bands that kind of like, oh, they got away from their what they liked. But then certain bands, like, they can get away with, like, not,
maybe they don't have any guidance
with evolving or not evolving. You know, like the Red Hot Chili Peppers is a good example. Like, they stay within this, you know, structure. They don't do a whole lot of different things, but they seem to, you know, they'll put in, you know, like a good meal, right? They'll work with the same 4 or 5 ingredients, but they'll kind of, you know, mix that up. So it seems like some artists are really good at evolving the formula because that's what their fans want.
Yeah.
And then some bands are like, let's not change what's working because that's what fans want. And then it's this, and then it's the other question I wanted to ask you too was about, like, do fans come with a formula and then bands come with a formula and they have to meet together, right? Like, that's what I was, or is one part of the equation the artist and then the fan is the other part of the equation. And when those two parts of the equation come together, then that's, you know, I see that at play, but I was just curious because we've been talking about the formula needs to evolve,
right?
But then there's some artists that are really like, they don't change what's working, and man,
they still make millions,
you know?
Maybe they just look really good, you know? That's the other piece about it.
Yeah,
their fan base. It might be the girl, the person's going, the girl, the guy going just to see this amazing human specimen.
Yeah.
For them,
right.
You know, like the Beatles, I think there's a lot of fans that went just to scream and say they got to see him. And Elvis, I mean,
these are
people. Like, I wonder if the music is important. I get it, and they have some amazing music, but I wonder if like 20% of their heart is really longing to see a good person up there, human up there, looking human.
Yeah,
it's a balance, right? It's a balance that every artist or their advisors or this whole system of artist, audience, and the whole everything around it, it's a balance that must be chosen, right? It's a balance between stability and change. And I mean, stability is great because you know what you're going to get. You know what to expect, and you're going to get it. And that's very comforting. But at the same time, innovation and change, I mean, too much of that can alienate the fans. But at the same time, you know, that is also what drives interest. And so how much of that do you do? I mean, at the extreme end, when I was studying music, as a student, I had a teacher who would tell me, never the same way twice. Mm. Yeah. So make sure you innovate constantly, and you never play the same thing to people the same way twice. And in a way, you know, no two performances can be exactly alike because we're not robots. But I think he was actually going beyond that. He's playing, you know, give new ideas, really present this in a different way, bring something out new that they've never heard before, something fresh, something that challenges them, challenges their expectations. So it's a choice, and maybe part of an artist's brand might be the stability, or you know what you can expect with this artist. Another one might be the constant innovation. You never know what you're going to get, and that's it's a choice, and it's a way to brand for each artist to choose the way they wish to brand themselves. I don't know if that's that answer your question.
I think there's a lot of ways to answer the question, but I think you've done a great job, a beautiful job of doing. And your work, you know, it just opens up this really exciting journey to understand,
potentially answer a lot of questions.
Understand our hearts, right? Every concert fan has a heart.
Right. You know? Well, yes.
Most
everyone
of us do.
Well, yeah, that's right.
Right. But a physical heart. I mean, a physical heart, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. A live beating heart that responds to everything. Yeah. That's our hope. We're very excited by the work, and we hope that others will join us, and that it will also bring new knowledge that would help us understand these experiences.
Yeah, great. And then I know you're involved in you mentioned two European Research Council projects. Can you tell us about those and your current work and how that's evolving today?
Yeah, I am. I lead two ERC, European Research Council projects. One is called Cosmos. It's about music, but music is like the cosmos. It's about computational modeling and shaping of music, and in a way, it's using mathematical and data science techniques to understand the work of performers. So for most of us, the music that we hear is music that has been performed by musicians. And what is it that the musician brings to the music? How do they shape the experience? How do they communicate ideas to people? What's the difference between one artist and another one? This is what we're trying to capture. And we're trying to do that in a data science and citizen science approach, because we're asking people to tell us what it is they hear. And so we've built software on the web to allow people to tell us what it is they hear and to annotate music. So that's one project. We're still in the process of collecting data and trying to get people to tell us what it is they hear and how they experience the music. But taking from that, once we understand how people, what it is they're hearing and how they're hearing it, we'd like to take that and to give it, to take it to the next step. So given that we know how people are perceiving the music, can we then use that in therapies for cardiovascular disease? So how can we then use that to understand how that affects the body, the heart, and to harness that information to design therapies for the heart that could chosen to have specific effects on the body. And that's the second project, which is called Heart FM. It's not a radio station. Heart FM simply refers to the fact that this is, we're looking at music and how it affects the heart and whether we can find ways to describe the music and the heart responses so that we can link them up to use them in tailored, personalized therapies that are beneficial for the heart.
So yeah, your work is super interesting and inspiring, and thank you so much for taking the time to dive into these topics with us and share your work with us.
Thank you so much. Yeah, it's been a pleasure, and I, you know, I feel like we've traveled around the cosmos on this.
Live Fix Podcast is a production of Live Fix Media and is produced by Chris and Colleen Catania. Hey, we know every concert fan has a live music story to share, and we'd love to share yours in a future episode. So head on over to livefixpodcast.com and click on Share Your Story. We look forward to hearing from you. Like what you heard? Did you get inspired by the stories of your fellow concert fans? Then help support Live Fix Podcast by subscribing and sharing a review on iTunes or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. We appreciate your support, and thanks for listening.